voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard streaming live worldwide at WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest today is Jeffrey Rosen, George Washington University Professor of Law and a leading expert on the United States Constitution. Welcome, Professor Rosen, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk.
Thank you. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Jeffrey Rosen is a professor of law at the George Washington University and the legal affairs editor of The New Republic. His most recent book is The Supreme Court, Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. He's also the author of The Most Democratic Branch, The Naked Crowd, and The Unwanted Gaze. He's a graduate of Harvard University, summa cum laude, Oxford University, where he was a Marshall Scholar, and the Yale Law School. Professor Rosen's essays and commentaries have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly. He's been on National Public Radio, and he's been published in The New Yorker, where he's been a staff writer. And, of course, the Chicago Tribune recently named him one of the 10 best magazine journalists in America, and the L.A. Times called him the nation's most widely read and influential legal commentator. Professor Rosen lives in Washington, D.C., with his wife and his two sons. Before I start the program today, I want to state that we are a country of laws, and the violence directed against Representative Gabrielle Giffords, along with the murders of a federal judge and other innocent people, is a crime against our way of life, no less a tragedy for the victims, their families, and all who know and love them. Editorially, I believe that anti-government and anarchistic rhetoric adds to this climate of intolerance and violence. All of us must decide what type of society we want, the rule of law or chaos. Getting on to our subject today, in the 1930s, the Supreme Court was dominated by a conservative block of justices. It was variously characterized by many as the nine old men. This conservative wing, whose supporters almost unilaterally supported the rights of property ownership and were universally against the expansion of government, were dominated by justices nicknamed the Four Horsemen, Van Devanter, Butler, McReynolds, and Sutherland. The so-called swing vote on this court was Justice Owen Roberts. Professor Rosen, please tell us what happened to the power of this block, and could you elaborate on the change that came as the New Deal became codified in law?
Well, the Four Horsemen during the New Deal lost their power when Justice Roberts, who, as you say, was the swing justice, changed his mind. This was in 1937. It was called the switch in time that saved nine, because right after President Roosevelt had threatened to pack the court and the conservative majority was feeling the heat, Roberts decided to uphold rather than strike down a crucial New Deal program. And after that, the court essentially got out of the business of striking down laws on the basis of disputed economic theories. And between 1937 and 1995, the court didn't strike down a single law as exceeding Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. What's so relevant about this historical drama today is people are wondering whether we're about to see a resurrection of the kind of conservative judicial activism that was most prominent during the New Deal. Will the Roberts Court strike down health care in the way that it struck down campaign finance reform? Might it strike down other financial regulations? And might we see a resurrection of efforts to restrict congressional power to regulate the economy that really we've not seen since the New Deal period?
You know, Professor Rosen, the court is made up of four of the six most conservative justices since 1937. Statistically, these four, Roberts, Scalia, Alito, and Thomas, have voted on the right between 71% and 82% of the time. In comparison, the so-called four horsemen of the early New Deals voted conservative between 48 and 52% of the time. Of course, times and issues have changed since the 1930s. Are these judges out of the mainstream of American thinking, or are they representing or directing a philosophical change in the American thought process?
As you say, comparisons are difficult, and it's hard to know how some of these cases come down. Is a decision striking down campaign finance reform on First Amendment grounds liberal or conservative? Some civil libertarian liberals supported it. But broadly, I don't think you can say that this court is out of the mainstream in any sense, because like previous courts, many of its decisions are broadly popular with the mainstream of the American public, on cases ranging from affirmative action to religion to federal power. So far, this court has rarely handed down decisions that have inflamed the public. Now, there are exceptions. Citizens United was unpopular with 80% of the country, both Republican and Democratic. And a decision striking down health care might provoke a similar backlash, although, of course, that reform has now lost some of its popular support. It's popular with only about 43%. But broadly, I agree with the author Barry Friedman, who has a very good book out called The Will of the People. And Friedman argues, as others have, that the Supreme Court has tended to stay within the mainstream, and on the rare occasions when it leaves the mainstream, it often provokes backlashes that lead to a judicial retreat.
Who would be considered the judge today that holds the balance in this struggle between, let's call it, the four most conservative justices and four justices today that would be considered quite liberal? Who is this justice?
It would be Anthony Kennedy, who's widely considered the swing justice, the Owen Roberts of his day. When he's in the majority more than any other justice, when he votes left, the court goes left. When he votes right, the court goes right. He plays that role a little less deftly than his predecessor, Sandra Day O'Connor, did. When she was the swing justice, she was better at reflecting the views of the moderate mainstream of the country. Kennedy is actually quite conservative on a range of issues, from federalism to affirmative action to religion. So he is moving the court to the right, but if there's a swing justice, then it would be Kennedy. Mm.
You know, on this show, I've had a number of programs devoted to the United States Supreme Court, which have included authors Professor Noah Feldman, Jeff Schessel, Bert Solomon, and the esteemed lawyer Michael Shapiro, and they have talked at length about the court since FDR's time. They've talked about some of the opinions. Speaking of the critical case that you just mentioned, in the case of Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission, is this a harbinger of what is to come? And what was the case about? And what are the far-reaching consequences of Citizens United?
The Citizens United case was about the constitutionality of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. And the question was whether the producers of a political documentary called Hillary the Movie could be banned from broadcasting their film several days before an election, as the law required. And by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said no. They said that corporations have free speech rights, just as citizens do, and therefore they couldn't be banned from speaking right before an election. It was a hugely important case, both in the breadth of its implication that corporations have the same rights as natural people, and in its signal that there is a possibility that the court might continue down this path and strike down financial reform, health reform, and other centerpieces of President Obama's regulatory agenda. Now, is it a harbinger? We'll find out. I mean, it's very hard to predict what the court will do on health care reform. It's just as likely that they might say that the First Amendment is different, and when it comes to economic regulation, they'll be more deferential to Congress. So we'll see. But Citizens United, of course, provoked President Obama to denounce the court from the well of Congress, provoking John Roberts, the Chief Justice, to say that the court felt uncomfortable and as a result would skip future State of the Union addresses. It certainly was a politically fraught case.
No question about it. Now, just to elaborate a bit on this, of course, the court ruled in a sense that since unions could give to political parties, political action parties, PACs as they were called, and the union membership wasn't in control of their monies, they felt that corporations were equal to balancing the scales. Is there a concern that the amount of money that corporations can pour into these campaigns far outweighs what unions can?
Yes, indeed. They could drown out unions and, of course, drown out individuals. And the theory on which McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform was based is that when you have huge amounts of corporate money in the public sphere, individuals are unable to make their own voices heard, and you need some sort of regulation to equalize the playing field. The court said that that theory of equality was antithetical to the First Amendment, that there could be no effort to suppress the speech of some in order to enhance the speech of others, and they seem to have a much more libertarian vision that's not sympathetic to this kind of equalization theory.
And I think most people should be concerned with the escalation of the cost of campaigns. Millions of dollars for a congressional campaign, tens of millions for a senatorial campaign. We're coming up against a short financial news update. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Professor Jeffrey Rosen. When we come back, I want to discuss Professor Rosen's very critical and important New York Times article, Radical Constitutionalism and the Tea Party. We'll be back in a moment or so.
News at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD2.
From the Fox Business Network, Wall Street seeing green across the board after a successful bond auction in Portugal eased worry about Europe's debt crisis. This ahead of the Federal Reserve's release of its beige book. That'll take place at 2 o'clock Eastern. The Dow right now, about 12 o'clock, is up 100 points. Shares of ITT are soaring as the company unveils plans to split into three publicly traded companies. The engineering and manufacturing company is spinning off its water and defense businesses. Under the plan, ITT shareholders will own shares in all three corporations. ITT expects to finalize the split before the end of the year. And changes coming to the S&P 500. Oil drilling firm Noble will be added to the index. It replaces QLogic, which will replace CommScope on the S&P MidCap 400 index. CommScope is going private, so it's being removed from the index. Those changes all take effect after Friday's close. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
The New York Times reported that over 130 million credit and debit cards were recently stolen. I'm Police Chief Joe DeLaterante. Why risk identity theft when just $10 a month helps protect you? I signed up for LifeLock, and you should too.
Enroll now and mention Radio 60 to try LifeLock risk-free for 60 days. Cancel LifeLock within 60 days to receive a full refund. 1-800-440-4894. 800-440-4894. Chief Joe DeLaterante is a compensated endorser.
This is America's great community radio station.
Really seems to be in touch with the heartbeat of the city.
AM 1460 WVOX.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. I'm with my guest, Professor of Law Jeffrey Rosen, who has recently written an article in the New York Times about the new radical constitutionalism. Professor Rosen, who is the newly elected senator from Mike Lee from Utah, and what are his views on the Constitution, and are they dangerous, and is this radical constitutionalism?
Mike Lee, the newly elected senator from Utah, has a very distinguished establishment legal background. He is a graduate of Brigham Young University. He was a former law clerk to Judge and then Justice Samuel Alito, so he's certainly has his legal chops in order. Now, his views, I think, can be considered radical because they would really call into question much of the post-New Deal regulatory state. Lee has expressed sympathy for the theory of nullification which says that states should be able to disregard laws like the federal health care law with which they disagree. Lee has questioned the constitutionality of some federal regulatory agencies, such as the Education Department and the Environmental Protection Agency. He has a very narrow view of congressional power that would call into question the health care reform, and the list goes on. Lee's views, are they dangerous? I think that I wouldn't use that word. I think it's legitimate to be able to argue for whatever your vision of the Constitution is. And the truth is that Lee's views are widely shared by members of the Tea Party movement who have been embracing texts similar to his. But I think that they certainly would be a dramatic change in the way the federal government operates, and therefore they're well worth resisting.
It seems like many of these people want to go back to the Articles of Confederation. Is this what they really are interested in?
It's true that much of the Tea Party rhetoric does evoke not the, the Federalists, but the Anti-Federalists, who question the ability of the federal government to enforce economic laws for the entire nation. There's a difference, of course. The Anti-Federalists were suspicious of judicial power, whereas the Tea Party is trying to reverse its political defeats in the courts and convince the courts to strike down health care and economic legislation. Even Social Security and the Federal Reserve are viewed as unconstitutional by the Tea Party members. But I think you're right that this is far closer to the Anti-Federalists than the Federalists.
You know, the House of Representatives opened last week with a new leadership, a new agenda, a reading of the U.S. Constitution, and committee chair people that seem to be, for want of a better word, out for blood. Eisenhower, Nixon, Reagan, and the two Bush presidents have never attacked the legacy of FDR, in fact, and the New Deal. In fact, Ronald Reagan voted for FDR four times, and Eisenhower stated categorically that he wasn't elected to dismantle the New Deal. This new class of Tea Party adherents has promised to go, as you said, with Mike Lee and others, to reverse this. Are they for real, or is this bombast going to burst?
Oh, I think it's for real. I mean, these are sincerely held views, and they're views that have an intellectual pedigree. I mean, if there's a constitutional guru of the Tea Party movement, it would be W. Cleon Skousen, who wrote a 1980 book called The 5,000-Year Leap. It was endorsed by Glenn Beck and became a bestseller. But Skousen attacks not only the New Deal, as you suggest, but also the progressive era. His boogeyman is Woodrow Wilson and the path-breaking achievements of the progressive era, such as minimum wage and maximum hour laws and the constitutional amendments authorizing the income tax and the popular election of senators. So in that sense, you're right that it is far more radical than mainstream Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon. It's not a coincidence that William F. Buckley denounced Skousen in the 1960s as being outside the mainstream of conservative thought. And for that reason, he sort of languished for many decades. So there are plenty of mainstream conservative writers who are concerned about this sort of rhetoric, and it has very, very sweeping implications.
Now, of course, we hear this anti-government rhetoric regarding Medicare, Social Security. There are people that want to cut back on government, the Tea Party does. Are they willing to touch Medicare, Social Security, the military? And it is important to note that the New York Times lead editorial a few days ago asked Speaker John Boehner, when he called for these $100 billion in cuts, literally put up and shut up. Where are the cuts that that Boehner and the Tea Party that's pressuring him, where are these cuts envisioned to be? Is there an idea on that?
I don't know exactly what they're planning, but you're certainly right that when the rubber hits the road, although Skousen and other Tea Party constitutionalists say that Social Security is unconstitutional and should be repealed or struck down, it's too popular to actually repeal, and many Tea Party members themselves, at the same time as they theoretically denounce these agencies, will say, don't touch my own Social Security. So in the end, Boehner, of course, is not a Tea Party member, and as a practical politician, he's going to face the same constraints that all mainstream politicians do, and I would be surprised if any of these longstanding entitlement programs actually get cut in any significant way.
You know, the interesting fact, and just in the discussion before our next break, the interesting fact that people don't seem to focus on is that federal taxes have been quite low for a long time. Not that people love taxes in the least. And most of the grousing and the ammunition in terms of the anti-tax people, especially Tea Party, are really voted on locally. They're dealing with, and especially education in most states, it's not only the state who deals with it, but it's the local community. And these communities have had Democrats and Republicans, legislators, control of legislators, Democrat and Republican governors, who've gone along with this for decades. Right or wrong, is it the fact that the growth of our government has not been outrageous, but it's the a problem of revenues that have come out of the crash of 2008?
Well, I'm not an economist and won't diagnose the situation that way, but I will say that the Tea Party people are consistent. They're against not only federal power, but against state power, and they believe that many state entitlements should fall as well. This is not a practical view, which is why Tea Partyists will always be a minority of the country as a whole. Someone estimated that strong libertarian sentiment is less than 20%, even in the most conservative states. And when push comes to shove, these programs at the state and federal level are just too popular to actually have anyone touch them.
It's very interesting how the climate of argument has changed over the last 6 months or a year. We have to go to a commercial break. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming at WVOX.com. I'm talking to Professor Jeffrey Rosen. We're talking about the new constitutionalists in the body of the Tea Party. When we come back, I want to ask Professor Rosen the following question. If the Tea Party branch and their powerful citizens lobby take over the GOP, will we see 2 years of gridlock, filibusters, and vetoes? We'll be back in a moment or so. Thank you.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. Police in Arizona say Jared Loughner, the man accused of killing six people in Tucson Saturday, was pulled over and given a warning for running a red light that morning. One of the wounded survivors, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, remains in critical condition.
We have really decreased the amount of sedation that we're giving her. And as a result of that, she's becoming more and more spontaneous all the time.
Dr. Peter Rhee a few minutes ago in Tucson. Giffords' colleagues in the House are working on a resolution to honor all the victims. President Obama leaves the White House in a few minutes to fly to Tucson for tonight's memorial. The East Coast storm dumping snow on New England, shutting down Boston's Logan Airport.
They've canceled most of their flights up until mid-afternoon and maybe the whole day.
Logan Airport spokesman Phil Orlandola. Airports in Connecticut and around New York City still at virtual standstills. Fox News. We report. You decide.
Our community programs are brought to you today by Young & Bartlett, Westchester's leading law firm for negligence, personal injury cases, and medical malpractice. Relying on 55 years of legal experience, partner Francis X. Young and his legendary father before him have been great advocates recovering millions of dollars for those unfortunate individuals who were injured in any way, including victims of medical malpractice, construction job site accidents, motor vehicle accidents, or defective products. Young and Bartlett are actual trial attorneys who stand right up for you and your rights in the courtroom. Partner Mayo Bartlett of this top-notch firm also specializes in civil rights cases and criminal defense. Calling on his many years as assistant DA under famed crime fighters Carl Vergari and Janine Pirro. Today, Young & Bartlett is at 81 Main Street in White Plains at Lexington, two blocks from Metro North. Attorneys Frank Young and Mayo Bartlett. Two great lawyers, two dedicated advocates. Check them out at young-bartlett.com or by calling 914-285-1500.
Okay, class. Today's lesson is on cleanliness. Raise your hands if you think dip-in car wash of Mamaroneck is a great place for your valuable automobile. Ah, good. Everyone is in agreement. Now tell me, what should my precious car expect when it enters the loving hands of owner Rocco Dalvito and the staff of Dippin' Car Wash? Very good. You already know that Dippin' Car Wash is famous for their wide range of car washing techniques, including my favorite, Super Polish Wash, Anti-Wax Protection Hot Wax, and their Power Shower, which effectively removes excess dirt from your automobile. Class, did you also know the famous Dippin' Car Wash offers Armor All for your tires and interior? Dip-In Car Wash is open 7 days a week in Mamaroneck at 712 Mamaroneck Avenue, or call 914-698-9515. Westchester's famous Dip-In Car Wash has the most courteous attendants who will be glad to explain the many services now available at Westchester's premier car wash.
Most people resist change and try to hold on to the past, but change is inevitable and the future is upon us. In fact, at no other time in our history has a society been subject to such an accelerated degree of transformation. From technology to communications, to global markets and commerce, we've seen dramatic shifts that have corresponding and drastic adjustments to the landscapes of business, politics, and our everyday lives. This is Andy Spano. Monday at 10, we'll talk about these topics and more. The show is called Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Each week on WVOX, we'll talk about how we got here, where we are, and where we are going. Join me Monday morning at 10 on 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Our weather forecast for this Wednesday afternoon, calling for clouds and sun, the possibility of some snow showers. Some blowing snow also likely. Temperatures ranging to near 30. Northwest winds at 10 to 15. They'll be gusting up to 25. For tonight, partly cloudy and brisk. Overnight lows in the upper teens. Thursday's looking mostly sunny with our highs near 30. On Thursday night, mostly clear. 15 to 20. Mostly sunny on Friday. Our highs in the upper 20s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD.
The station everyone at work can agree on.
Everybody at work's listening to it.
AM 1460, WVOX, New Rochelle, and WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates and my guest, Professor Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University School of Law, who's one of America's top experts on the United States Constitution. Before our break, I asked him the following question. If the Tea Party Republicans and their powerful citizen lobby take over the GOP, will or could we see 2 years of gridlock, filibusters, and vetoes? Is that a possibility?
It is. Of course, you wouldn't even need a Tea Party takeover to have that scenario. Mm. And the prospects of the Tea Party taking over the GOP are slim for now. There really were only a handful of Tea Party senators who were elected, about four of them, and a bunch of House members as well. So I think their influence and their public rhetoric is stronger than their actual ability to deliver votes right now, but the possibility of gridlock is definitely real.
Now, you know, the GOP has stated recently that they want to limit the power of senatorial filibusters. But in the last session of Congress, there were over 90 cloture votes. And in fact, those cloture votes were more than all the votes in the decade from 1950 to 1960, when there were many civil rights filibusters. And in fact, if you take out the civil rights filibusters by Southern congresspeople, Southern senators, virtually these 90 cloture votes were probably more than we had in 50 years. Now it seems that when the Democrats are in position to block legislation coming out of the House, how come the shoe is not on the other foot?
You know, the shoe goes back and forth depending on who's in control. And for the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, we've seen increasing calls to eliminate the filibuster every time a new party gets into power. When push comes to shove, usually the majority party is reluctant to pull the trigger because they know that they may be in the minority at some point soon. A more plausible reform is one that would allow the minority to slow down a bill without completely blocking it and would require a series of votes in order to keep the delay going. But again, I think there's a gap between the rhetoric here and what's actually likely to happen.
So you see the potentiality of gridlock. You see the potentiality of bills coming out of the House that are going to go directly, especially since the House controls all the finance bills. That's where they originate. You see this as a possibility of pressure on four or five Democrats to swing over. Could some of these bills go to the president for veto?
I think the question of the repeal of health care is obviously the central one, and it could certainly pass the House. And I don't know if it could pass the Senate. That seems like a stretch given current politics, although some Democratic senators are facing some heat and regretting their votes, but I'm not sure I'd put my money on that one.
Mm. You know, there's obviously a debt crisis facing all elements and levels of our government. We spoke about this a bit earlier. And a question for you as a professor of law and someone who looks back on the struggles of the passing of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, certainly Medicare and Medicaid, which have had a vast bipartisan support. Is it fair to look at these obligations, as we know as entitlements, in the federal operating budget? Is this fair, or are when we look at these long-term obligations as debt, is this a political, what you could say, MacGuffin?
Oh, I don't know. You know, all's fair in politics. You can argue it round or flat, as the lawyers say. So, it's an accounting question, but I guess the real one is the question you raised earlier, which is the new GOP majority actually going to be any more serious about reducing these obligations, whatever you call them, than their predecessors were? And I would tend to doubt it.
Yeah, because, you know, when you look at the budget, and of course, this is not budgetary economists here. When you look at the budget and you realize the obligations of the military, when you take out Social Security and Medicare, and you realize that the health bill, the Obama health care bill, was supposed to reduce the hemorrhaging caused from Medicaid, which is not an entitlement, which is paid for out of the federal budget. When you take that out and you realize that health care has a great deal to these costs, especially on Medicaid, military is a tremendous percentage of the operating budget. Where is there room to move? Is there wiggle room on the rest of the budget? Or are we going to look at something like the National Endowment of the Arts as the bogeyman to be sacrificed?
Well, again, if you take the Tea Party rhetoric seriously, then they are perfectly happy to cut Social Security. But the question is, what are the votes available for? And that's where I'm sort of skeptical that beyond the usual targets, which are the National Endowment for the Arts and fussing about subsidies for opera and things like that, you're going to see any really serious cuts.
Now, the first crisis being discussed is the issue of raising the debt service ceiling. Maybe you can mention to our listening audience what is debt service ceiling, and are the Republicans willing to force a constitutional confrontation which could affect the everyday operation of government? Remember, we saw that with Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton a generation ago. What is the debt service ceiling?
You better define it. I think you can do a better job than I can on that one.
Well, in other words, so our audience knows that the government has to pass continuing resolutions to support the government's everyday actions. Do you think that the Republican New Right are willing to shut down the government?
They're willing if they have the votes. The Gingrich people were in 95, and they got tremendous political pushback for it, and it was viewed as an overstep that ended up helping the Democrats. I don't think that the Tea Partyists would be afraid of the political backlash. They believe that this is a matter of constitutional principle, so they're willing to shut down the government if they can. But again, I'm not sure they got the votes to do it.
And how would you see this playing out? In other words, Bill Clinton was very facile and capable of doing this. From your perspective, without making a political judgment from the right, left, Democrat, Republican, how do you see Obama's skills in comparison to President Clinton's in dealing with this? How has he reacted to this challenge from the right?
He's been biding his time, and I think he's waiting to see what they'll actually do. But the Tea Partyists are more hardcore about this than the Gingrich Republicans were. They have pledged to require that every bill specify the constitutional authority on which it's purportedly based, and to refuse to vote for any bill that exceeds Congress's enumerated powers. So again, they may not have the votes, but they're going to attempt to vote against all sorts of authorizations that even the Gingrich Republicans might have taken for granted. And this can only serve to President Obama's benefit. I mean, he is at his best. He likes to be seen as a uniter who can bridge partisan divides. And if the GOP looks extremely partisan and obstructionist, then he can really play the statesman.
So in other words, some of these new committee chair people like Paul Ryan and Rand Paul and these individuals who are they're going to have to put up or shut up, it seems to me, very quickly. Where do you think we'll go on some of these new committee chair people? Any quick thoughts?
No, but Rand Paul is a very interesting character, a real libertarian, and someone to watch.
All right. You know, we have to go for a commercial break. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM, and we're live streaming on WVOX with my guest, Professor Jeffrey Rosen. We're talking about new constitutionalists in the body of the Tea Party. When we come back, I would like to discuss Professor Rosen's appearance at the Bill of Rights Institute and his debate with Professor Angelo Codevilla and his views on the diverse elements of American conservatism, which he discussed in that debate. Thank you. We'll be back in a moment.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. 4 days after the shooting rampage in Tucson, Arizona.
We still have six patients in the hospital. One patient remains in a critical fashion. Two are serious, and three are in fair condition.
Dr. Peter Reed, chief of trauma at University Medical Center in Tucson, Gabrielle Giffords' condition stable.
The update on the congresswoman at this time period is that it's going as anticipated.
Giffords, who was shot in the head, said to be less sedated and more responsive now. The president is attending a memorial service for shooting victims in Tucson tonight. Some of the flights delayed by the storm slamming the Northeast, returning to the skies. And the Lebanese government collapsing its president, heading to Paris after meeting with President Obama in Washington to deal with the crisis caused by the pullout of Hezbollah ministers and their allies from the cabinet. Fox News. We report, you decide.
A bolt or a nut. Or when I break a window and I need some glass cut. They got the solution to help me get it done. A local institution. They make hardware fun. Cornell's.
When we need to record a song, we go to the Loft Recording Studios. But when we need some hardware, we go to Cornell's. 310 White Plains Road, Route 22, Eastchester, New York.
Cornell's!
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of the Hugh Doyle Senior Center, Police Commissioner Pat Carroll, Ursuline Academy, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
Amplify your voice.
easy to work, press talk button.
AM 1460, WVOX, and WVIP HD2, New Rochelle.
The voice of Westchester, WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, Professor of Law Jeffrey Rosen of the George Washington University, who's also the legal affairs editor of the New Republic. Professor Rosen, you recently appeared on a nationally broadcast C-SPAN program on December 28, 2010, hosted by the Bill of Rights Institute with Professor Angelo Codavilla. The subject was, is there a coming culture clash over the U.S. Constitution? First question, who is the Bill of Rights Institute and what do they do? And what was this all about?
You know, it's a good question. I just met them at that event, and I enjoyed speaking to them, but I can't tell you what they did. They hosted a debate with Professor Codavilla, and I was happy to show up.
Okay. What was it all about? What was this debate about, and how was it engaged?
Well, Professor Codavilla has written a paper, an article, drawing a distinction between what he calls the country class and the knowledge class. Mm. And it's essentially a view that a conspiracy of elites is right. attempting to suppress the views of ordinary Americans, views ranging from judicial review to healthcare and economic reform, and he's calling for a resurrection of the views of the majority of Americans on these issues. And I took issue with much of his thesis. I agreed with him that the courts have tended to be responsive to public opinion, but I thought that many of the views that he ascribed to a majority of Americans weren't actually held by them, that in fact, polls show the opposite, that people are pretty happy with the courts policing the boundaries of the Constitution, but don't want the kind of vigorous judicial activism, striking down health care and financial reform and so forth, that he was calling to. So we had a good back and forth. I enjoyed it, and it was a vigorous debate.
Yeah, it's available. I think people should watch it. You know, as part of the discussion, and I watched it, and I told some of my legal friends to pay attention to it and find it on the web and to see it also. You stated in depth your views on the diverse elements of American conservatism today. Could you tell us your views and what these groups have in common and where do they differ? Who are these different groups?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I drew a distinction between three separate strands of legal conservatism, many of which point in different directions. First, there are the Tea Party conservatives, second, the Libertarian conservatives, and third, the pro-business conservatives. Mm. So the Tea Party people combine the kind of anti-federalist suspicion of national power with a religious conservatism that leads them to be suspicious of the wall between church and state. The Libertarian conservatives share the suspicion of federal power but are not at all religious conservatives. On the contrary, they tend to be pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, and clash with the Tea Party people on these social issues. And then third, there are the pro-business conservatives who, unlike the Tea Party people and the Libertarian, supported the Troubled Asset Relief Program, are in favor of intervention in the economy. They support the unified interests of American business. They've had a lot of luck on the Supreme Court, which has tended to be quite sympathetic to business interests, but they don't share the Tea Partyists and the Libertarians' suspicion of federal power.
Now, are the Wall Street, call it the pro-business conservatives, are they more socially liberal than the other two branches? Do they accept the idea that they want to stay away from that and are more tolerant? How do you view the Wall Street conservatives?
I think Wall Street conservatives would be closer to the Libertarians than the Tea Party people on social issues. In other words, sympathetic to abortion choice and to gay rights. They're not social conservatives. So there, that's yet another fissure which puts them against the Tea Party people with the Libertarians.
Now, since Jimmy Carter's time, the evangelical vote, which at one time was mostly Democratic, even on national elections, has really become an important facet in this conservative panoply. Where do the evangelicals fit in terms of this? Are they more leaning towards the Tea Party than the other groups?
It's a very interesting question. I'd imagine so, because of their social conservatism. But I'm not sure whether evangelicals share the kind of radical suspicion of state power that the Tea Party people do. The Tea Party constitutionalists, interestingly, have more of a Mormon than an evangelical base. Cleon Skousen, whom I mentioned, was a Mormon. Mike Lee is as well. And that is a kind of regional Utah-based movement that might put them at odds with evangelicals on some issues. That's an interesting fissure.
Now, how about the concept of faith-based initiatives? George Bush pushed this. There were many black churches that embraced it. There were many other religious groups that liked the idea of it. They took on some of the social responsibilities. And that bill has added up into the multi-billions, in fact, $7 or $8 billion. How do you see this faith-based initiative's future with the Tea Party and the evangelicals? How do you see that? Do you see a conflict on that?
Well, faith-based initiatives, of course, were supported not only by George Bush, but also by Clinton and Gore, who viewed them as a kind of religious neutrality. You'd allow individuals to decide whether they wanted federal welfare money to go to soup kitchens or to Catholic hospitals or to federal programs. Since the Tea Party people are suspicious of federal programs in all forms, they might be less sympathetic to that kind of Tea Party or to that kind of faith-based initiative than the evangelicals are.
Is faith-based initiative a challenge to the Establishment Clause?
Arguably not. I mean, there's a vision of the Establishment Clause based on the idea of religious neutrality, which says that as long as private choice rather than public choice determines the destination of funds, then it's not an establishment of religion. So school vouchers, by this rationale, are also constitutional because individual parents decide whether they want to take them to religious schools or private schools. On the contrary, by contrast, school prayer of any kind, which the Tea Party supports, is a violation of the Establishment Clause because there the state is putting its muscle and endorsement behind a particular religion.
Mm. You know, in our remaining time, we have some new members on the court. Justices Sotomayor and Kagan are women, Democrats and considered liberals. Will they have an impact on the court, especially on Justice Kennedy's thinking? And many have said they don't have, and I take this, I don't mean this by any insult, by no means. There have been complaints from the left that they don't have the intellectual rigor of a Roberts or Scalia. Is there any, what you could say, currency to that view?
Well, it's still too early to tell. You've got to give a justice several years on the bench to show their stuff. I have big hopes for Elena Kagan. She was just a superb dean of Harvard Law School, a great solicitor general, and in her questions at oral arguments, she's really been getting to the heart of constitutional issues in a way that suggests she very much has the ability to take on Roberts, and to the degree that Kennedy can be swayed, which is not always all that great, she might be able to sort of bring him over to the left in a few cases as well.
Now, with this in mind, do you see a Supreme Court reviewing again Roe v. Wade in the near future?
No. Justice Kennedy has made quite clear that he supports constitutional protection for early-term abortion, although he will allow the regulation of late-term abortion. And as long as Kennedy remains on the court, Roe is secure.
Now, also, with this horrendous shooting in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona, which I've been in, it's a very lovely town. I have a first cousin who lives there, and a friend of mine's daughter is there, and it's a real Western town, and I can understand people, you know, supporting guns and ownership there. I can understand that and deal with it as an Easterner that had never used a gun particularly. But what about this idea of a large ammunition clips that have been... That regulation was struck down by the Bush administration. How do you see this? Do you see this coming back again to the courts over what type of ammunition can be used, and especially regarding mass killings?
I mean, I guess the question would be what kind of ammunition can be banned if Congress were to ban that in light of these terrible killings. And the court didn't show its hand in its two decisions applying the Second Amendment's right to bear arms to the states and the federal government. It said that bans on gun possession in the home are unconstitutional, but did not say beyond that whether any particular regulations might or might not be okay. So it's quite possible that this court might say that's fine. You know, as long as you don't ban gun possession entirely, then you can regulate the kind of ammunition that's allowed. But we won't know until they get those cases.
Well, of course, we've heard over the years that guns don't kill people. People kill people. You know, that's been the the geschrei, if you want to use that term, of the NRA. That's been the mantra of it. If this individual, this whether he's a madman or not, I think that's a legal term, had a very small clip of five bullets, as most semi-automatics had up until certainly through the Second World War, five or six bullets, wouldn't it have been a lot less chaos and murder and mayhem?
Well, it does appear that it wasn't until after he got off his first round and was trying to reload that he could be tackled, so it couldn't have hurt.
Yeah. So, you know, it seems to me that this argument is sort of specious. Where do you see in the last few moments we have, what are some of the big cases coming up that you're aware of that maybe the public doesn't have on their horizon?
There are a bunch of fascinating cases involving privacy. Do corporations have privacy rights, and do individuals have privacy rights in their data? That's a case that's been a question that's been open since the 1970s, and if this court actually says that we cannot be surveilled by the government and our private sector data, that would be a huge advance for privacy.
Yeah, and of course, you've written a very interesting article in the New York Times. I suggest people look it up, called "The Web Means the End of Forgetting." That was a article that came out in July of 2010. I think all people who use the internet, all people who are interested, should take account of that. There have been certain cases over does a spouse have a right to the emails we've seen recently. Professor Rosen, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's very enlightening, very interesting, and it should be an exciting 2 years coming up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. You know, next week I'll be hosting author Hazel Rowley. We'll be discussing her book, Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage, and how this partnership shaped America. In fact, I'll be doing a lecture on Eleanor Roosevelt at the Rye Senior Citizen Center tomorrow at 10:30. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information on my guests will be posted. Have a great day, and stay off the roads if they're a little slick. Thank you very much, and have a good day. Bye-bye.